My Close Encounter with a Conspiracy Theory, published on Saturday, the 16th of January, 2021. This memo is one that I have wanted to write for many years. I had not done so up until now as, although it has some important lessons for investing, it is not primarily about investing. It is about an encounter I had with a conspiracy theory many years ago and the questions that have haunted me since. For some reason, the seemingly inconsequential act of starting a podcast channel for the purpose of narrating my investor letters, an act that took just a few minutes, gives me the sense of freedom to write about topics that go beyond the narrowly financial. I'm enjoying this freedom. One reason I wanted to write this memo is because I fear the mental illness I encountered preys on, amongst others, financially independent, internet savvy, analytical people who are curious about the world and have the time to connect the dots. In other words, it may, in rare circumstances, select for a similar demographic as my investor letters do. I do not lay claim to any clinical expertise in any of the phenomena my memo may either deliberately or inadvertently touch upon. I nevertheless want to recount the following anecdote for the same reason that someone who ran a popular club might want to reach out to all the members if a disproportionately high number of them contracted a rare form of cancer. He may not understand the correlation, there may not even be a correlation, but on balance, the better course of action would be to let the members know and allow them to make up their own minds. The encounter. My anecdote starts with me sitting around our kitchen table with my wife and children 6 years ago on an otherwise unexceptional Sunday afternoon. It was the middle of winter and we were trying to figure out how to squeeze out some excitement from the few hours of sunlight remaining before winding down into our evening routine. The odds did not look good. Then the phone rang from a Zurich number that I did not recognize. "Hey Rob, it's Jack here," said an old college friend whose name I have changed to protect his identity. "I'm calling from a payphone so I cannot speak long. I am in Zurich and was wondering if you want to meet up." I was delighted to hear from Jack. I had not heard from him since a few years after graduating and had fond memories of our time together at college. I thought it was strange he was calling me from a payphone, but figured either his phone battery was dead or perhaps he wanted to avoid the horrendous roaming charges in Switzerland. I gave the matter no further thought. Sooner than I expected, the doorbell rang and Jack entered the scene at our kitchen table. He looked no different from how I remembered him and happy to see me, as indeed I was to see him. He was keen to hear how I was doing, and in the first half hour or so I filled him in on how I'd got married, started a family, moved to Zurich, etc. The conversation was relaxed, fun, and felt like we picked up where we had left off 15 odd years before. I then asked him how he was doing. From one moment to the next, his expression changed as if a dark shadow had fallen over his face. "You're probably wondering why I called you from a payphone," he said. "Unfortunately, I have upset some very powerful people and they are out to get me." I was totally taken aback by what Jack had said, given the sudden change in the mood and the seriousness of his predicament. I immediately inquired what on earth had happened. He then went on to recount how he had recently been fired from a high-profile job trading derivatives in the City of London. He was unsure why he had been fired, but shortly beforehand, he had had a heated argument with his assistant. She was married to a middling official in the UK government, and Jack suspected the official was so incensed by the treatment of his wife that he was out for revenge. Not only did he work his powerful connections to get Jack fired, but he also had Jack's name placed on a list of suspected terrorists. If I was initially taken aback, I was now in a state of full-blown shock. I was desperately upset about the misfortune that had befallen my friend. During my own brief sojourn in the City of London, I experienced firsthand how political large banks can be and how vindictive some individuals are if you get on the wrong side of them. I asked him to go on. He told me that fortunately he was financially secure as he had earned well as a trader and also received a large severance package when he was fired. He had bought a large house next door to his parents. It was a relief that he was at least financially okay. He told me that he spent a large part of the day investigating his suspicions and had turned up multiple documents as well as first-hand sources confirming that such lists exist and he was on them. Could he really be sure all this was true? I asked. starting to feel a vague sense of unease. "I wish it was not," he responded. Having exhausted all other options, he saw no alternative other than to address himself to the highest echelons of UK society. He went to the top, David Cameron, then Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. "Call off your lackeys," he told me he had written to the Prime Minister, "or else there will be consequences. It would be a huge mistake to underestimate me." Jack had exercised all the restraint he could muster and was running out of patience. He believed he had unwittingly uncovered a conspiracy going to the highest levels of government in which innocent victims are placed on lists of suspected terrorists and subjected to round-the-clock surveillance just to settle petty scores of middling officials. His own treatment was just the tip of the iceberg. "Rob, what I know has the power to bring down the entire British government, and if pushed, I am not afraid to use it," he said with a look of the man who holds all the aces. The magnitude and reach of what I was hearing was starting to get a little bit too much for me to process. "Shortly after I sent the letter," he went on, "multiple neighbours as well as complete strangers approached me around town, confirming to me that the police were snooping around, asking questions about me." This was the clincher argument from his perspective. It was not just people he knew. Complete strangers were confirming to him his worst fears. For me, it was the moment that the spell was broken. If you send a threatening letter to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, an alternative explanation sprang to my mind. Perhaps they were sending the police around to assess how great a threat he posed and how seriously to take it. I tentatively suggested to Jack this alternative explanation. Jack would have none of it, and instead recounted another story to illustrate the extreme lengths the authorities were going to pursue him. He recently booked a vacation to Mauritius in order to get as far away from things as possible and wind down. Things had started really well, and he met a beautiful girl at a bar. Finally, he had the chance to be free and have a crack at happiness. Then, ominously, he noticed two guys at the bar. "They even followed me all the way to Mauritius," he sighed. "That's how far they're willing to go." He even feared that the beautiful girl was a honey trap sent to ensnare him. Reluctantly, he said goodbye to the girl and returned to the UK earlier than planned. "What I really want, Rob, is to have what you have," he told me, gesturing to the scene in my kitchen. "But they won't let me have it." "Listen, Jack," I responded. "All I know is based solely on what you have told me over the last few hours. But based on what you have told me, I am almost certain as I possibly can be, that this is a figment of your imagination. You need to do everything in your power to rid yourself of this delusion." Then a shadow fell across his face again, like it had done at the beginning of his story several hours before. "Damn," he cried. "They managed to get to you before I could." And that, basically, is where the conversation ended. Now, I solemnly swear that I am not a Secret Service agent on the payroll for the British government. Even if all the evidence, the devilish good looks, the dangerous glint in the eye, the ability to take down three men twice my size in a heartbeat, seems to point to the contrary, humour me for the rest of this memo that I am a fund manager in Zurich who received a visit from an old friend. What follows are the questions I've asked myself after that afternoon. Let me be clear, though, that despite the long recounting of my afternoon with Jack, it is not my intention to analyse Jack's condition. I have zero qualification to do so. I am simply using that afternoon as a means to sharpen my own thinking around the topics of mental illness, conspiracies, how we evaluate information, and the implications for investing. Question 1. Can the brain catalyze its own mental illness? What I found profoundly disturbing about that afternoon is the glimpse at the possibility that an individual can catalyze his or her own mental illness. I always assumed that mental illness was something that happened to the brain, either due to a disease from within, such as Alzheimer's, or physical or emotional trauma from without, such as a blow to the head or the loss of a close family member, or a combination of both, perhaps with one reinforcing the other. The encounter with Jack showed me the possibility that an otherwise healthy mind could catalyze its own destruction with relatively little influence either from a disease or trauma. Jack's delusion was at least in part caused by the perhaps initially innocuous decision to entertain the idea that he had been fired for upsetting powerful people. This set him down a rabbit hole from which to this date, to my knowledge, he has been unable to escape. Question 2. Are we overlooking the damage to the individual from conspiracy theories? Much is made of the destructive power of conspiracy theories to society. We have just experienced how the conspiracy theory that the US presidential election was stolen catalyzed a violent march on the Capitol with the death of 5 people. What struck me, though, is the destructive capacity of a conspiracy theory to the individual. Jack's delusion that he is a marked man has effectively hijacked his brain and rendered it virtually useless. It cannot complete the most basic tasks for leading a fulfilling life, such as forming relationships and holding down a job. Jack is alienated from both his family and his friends. Question 3. Is financial independence the blessing it appears to be? At first blush, Jack's financial independence seems to be a godsend. Everything is collapsing around him, but at least he does not need to worry about a roof over his head. I cannot help but feel, though, that it may be part of the problem. Had he not had any money, perhaps he would have rolled up his sleeves and got on with things rather than brood over his unfair treatment at the hands of his former employer. His financial independence gave him the time to spend long hours on the internet seeking out information that confirmed his darkest fears. And there is so much information out there that you can find almost anything you want if you look long enough. There is even a guy in Zurich, of all places, that compares French barrel makers and Kiwi retirement operators. Question 4. Are we all at risk? What I also find disturbing is how easy it would be to slip into Jack's rabbit hole. There are a number of simple steps, with each one naturally following on from the prior one. In step 1, he blamed getting fired on the perfidy of others. This is an understandable reaction to a horrible experience. It is most likely a rare person that loses their job and accepts it is their fault or perhaps just bad luck. In step 2, he developed a theory on whose fault it was, which most likely had its basis in at least some facts. He may well have upset his former assistant. Her husband could have been a civil servant, and the police almost certainly checked him out after he sent a threatening letter to the Prime Minister. In step 3, Jack connected the dots between these facts and the data found on the internet to form a broader theory about why he had been fired. He had the means, as he was financially independent. He had the opportunity, as he was smart with plenty of time on his hands. And he had the motivation. His conspiracy theory was no doubt more alluring than this banality of quotidian existence. The reason he could not have the beautiful girl was not that she was indifferent to him. It was because she was a honey trap sent by the secret services. The reason the Prime Minister did not reply to Jack's letters was not because he had no idea who Jack was. It was because Jack was onto him and he knew it. It is terrifying to consider how easily we might be ensnared by a conspiracy theory. An innocuous click on a link in a moment of ennui can send the brain into a downward spiral that leads to its own destruction as assuredly as the first division of a cancer cell. Question 5. Is the problem more widespread than it appears? Jack is the most extreme example I have encountered where the parasite, the delusion, has quite literally taken over the host. At the other end of the spectrum are people who take a passing interest in the conspiracy theory du jour. When I look at my broader circle of acquaintances, I see some people at various points along the spectrum. Some have an, in my view, uncomfortably detailed knowledge about something as inconsequential to them as to whether America landed on the moon, but seem otherwise to lead normal lives. Others seem to have developed an overpowering interest in, for example, the stability of the international monetary system, which may impair their enjoyment of life. Thankfully, none are nearly as far along the spectrum as Jack. They do, though, bear some uncanny similarities to Jack. They're usually middle-aged, financially independent, internet-savvy, and have lots of excess brain power. They seem to prefer to view themselves as a detective unearthing a massive global conspiracy, than the dude who takes out the milk bottles and walks the dog. It is understandable and presumably harmless most of the time, to the individual, if not to society in aggregate. However, as my experience with Jack taught me, the risk to the individual is perhaps greater than it appears. Once you start to go down a rabbit hole, there comes a point where it's seemingly impossible to escape. When I, a well-meaning friend, pointed out to him that he was mistaken, he simply viewed me as a spy sent by the UK government. It did not help him escape from his delusion. It sent him still further down the rabbit hole. Those were my questions. But what are the implications for investing? This memo is not primarily about investing. It is a warning about the dangers to the individual in addition to society from conspiracy theories, and it is directed at a readership that may be at an above average risk of succumbing to their allure. That being said, there are obvious read-throughs for investing. Jack's story is primarily one about processing information. He develops a hypothesis that he was fired for upsetting powerful people, and then goes out into the world to gather as much information as possible to validate his hypothesis. The job of an investor is also to process information. An investor develops a hypothesis or mental model about what constitutes a great investment. He or she then goes out into the world gathering as much information from as many disparate sources as possible to identify investment opportunities that map to that mental model. In my particular case, I happen to think that a great investment is made up of managers who set the right example, a growing competitive advantage, and an attractive valuation. I try to validate whether a company correctly maps to my mental model by, for example, reading annual reports, visiting the companies, interviewing their leaders, and seeking out alternative opinions from competitors or former employees. Other investors may think other factors are more important or place more weight on some other sources of information. The basic challenge remains the same for everyone, though. Jack's story can be thought of as a cautionary tale where the processing of information goes terribly wrong with tragic consequences. The corollary in investing would be either forming the wrong hypothesis of what constitutes a great investment, or having the right mental model but incorrectly identifying the attributes we are looking for. So what investing lessons can be derived from Jack's story? Lesson number one, humility is the first commandment. The single most important tool we have in our armor to defend ourselves against bad theory is humility. It is absolutely vital that we always allow for the possibility that we are wrong. Much is made of striking the correct balance between conviction in a good idea and openness to the possibility of being wrong. What Jack's story makes perfectly clear is that if there were an imaginary optimal line between the two traits, you do not want to be anywhere near it. The downside from being on the wrong side of the line is just too large compared to the incremental benefit from just being on the right side. Had Jack had the tiniest doubt about his theory, it may have provided an opening through which a loving family and concerned friends could have inserted counter-arguments that acted like an antibodies on a virus. Lesson number two, incentives matter. Incentives really matter. No, I am not referring to management fees, performance fees, and so on. I suspect that any monetary incentive makes the job of forming good theory more, not less difficult. I am referring to what our deepest motivations are. Are they to get rich? Are they to find the mythical 10-bagger? If they are, we are incentivized to put the dots together in such a way that an investment appears to have the attributes we are looking for. It is the equivalent of the guy in the bar who cannot have the beautiful girl because she is a honey trap. I realized early on when I started investing that if my goal was to buy the next big thing, and I only made a handful of investment decisions a year, I was going to go home frustrated most days. Instead, I redefined the quest to understand business a little bit better every day, a mission that is eminently more achievable. This is reflected in how I approach meetings with management. I simply use them to build up as complete an understanding of the business as the allotted time allows. It is not my aim to form an opinion after one meeting on whether I have just witnessed a 10-bagger. Occasionally, though, I find a business sufficiently interesting that I continue to study it. Even more occasionally, it ends up in the portfolio. What motivates me need not be what motivates you, but you had better be sure that your motivation aligns well with your goals, or else they will lead you astray. At some point, Jack's understandable motivation to make sense of why he had been fired no longer aligned with his goal of being happy. The consequences were tragic. The consequences of a bad investment decision are normally not tragic, unless you're managing money for a mafia boss, but they are to be avoided. Lesson number 3, the importance of competing hypotheses and disconfirming information. Many years ago, I read The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis by Richard Sawyer, a former CIA agent. The book describes how the CIA trains agents to overcome their natural biases when processing information. He wrote that it is incredibly important to list all possible hypotheses, not just the most probable ones, but also the most absurd and outrageous ones. This is the only way to retain an open mind about all possible scenarios, not just the more probable ones. As we saw with Jack, once a hypothesis is foreclosed, it is incredibly difficult to put it back on the table. The corollary in investing would be to articulate competing hypotheses, for example, that a company does not have a moat or has a deteriorating moat. Hoyers also wrote that it is incredibly important to seek out disconfirming as well as confirming information. Having formed hypotheses, the natural inclination is to seek out confirming information. Given that there is so much information out there, this is not likely to be all that difficult to find. This makes it even more critical to seek out disconfirming information too. Part of Jack's problem was that having decided that he was a marked man, he sought only confirming information and was able to find it. In investing, the corollary for me has been to build up a network of critical but like-minded investors. I prefer this to hiring analysts, for example, as I think there is a natural tendency for employees not to want to upset the boss. I have found that independent and successful fund managers are far more likely to tell me as it is. Lesson number 4, write it down. It is incredibly important to write things down. The human brain has a tendency to ignore or downplay hypotheses we disagree with and information that does not fit with our beliefs. The best antidote to this tendency is to physically write down competing hypotheses and all the facts. It is also important to write down the type of information which, were it to come to light in the research process, would invalidate a theory. This protects us from bending the theory to fit the facts, rather than simply dismissing the theory. Jack presumably sought me out as an unbiased friend who could help him make sense of his situation. It might have helped him if he had documented his motivation to meet me beforehand. Instead, rather than accept my advice, he just adjusted his theory. Damn, they managed to get to you before I could. For me, my investor letter has been the best example of where I've benefited from writing things down. The letter has helped me to avoid some of the pitfalls that Hoyers refers to when processing information. It creates an indelible account of why I have invested in something that I cannot simply rewrite if things do not go to plan. There is also a vibrant community, those of you reading this, who are itching to point it out when disconfirming information comes to light. If something goes wrong at one of my investments, there is zero chance I will not hear about it. When Novo Nordisk had a setback a few years ago, one blogger even wrote a multi-page memo on everything I got wrong. I bet he will sleep less easy this evening knowing I might be a Secret Service agent. Lesson number 5, caveat short sellers. My strong sense is that conspiracy theories are more prevalent on the short side, those who bet on falling share prices, than on the long side, those who bet on rising share prices. I am often astonished by the contortions that short sellers sometimes undertake to paint a company in the worst possible light. In the interest of balance, I guess they would probably say the exact same thing about long-only investors. I believe the phenomenon has its counterpart in the real world, where you find both paranoia and pronoia, a neologism indicating the opposite of paranoia. However, the former is far more prevalent than the latter, presumably because paranoia was a better survival strategy on the savannah. As I am an upbeat person, and this memo has been quite dystopian, I'm going to go off on a tangent on pronoia now. Remember, it's my podcast, so I can do anything I want. Wichteln. There is a Christmas tradition in Swiss schools called Wichteln, which I believe is called Secret Santa in English-speaking countries. Each pupil is allocated a classmate at random at the start of December and then has to try and sneak presents into their school bag without exposing their identity. I love the idea of my children spending an entire month trying to figure out which of their classmates are out to delight them. I may try to implement something similar at my next annual gathering. Perhaps everyone can anonymously gift their favourite book to someone chosen at random. I love the idea of everyone mixing in the room trying to figure out who their secret benefactor is. Where the analogy of investing and conspiracy theories breaks down. I do not want to stretch the analogy of investing and conspiracy so far as to be guilty of the same crime that I am attempting to describe. One important difference is that finding good investment opportunities is hard. Spotting conspiracy theories generally is not, at least for the open-minded outsider. A feature of a conspiracy theory is that it distorts the facts in increasingly imaginative and absurd ways as it grows. This makes it easy to spot for the diligent investor. The theory of cognitive dissonance explains well why this trajectory is inevitable. People find it painful to hold two contradictory eyes in their minds at the same time. For example, their self-view as being rational and the increasing body of evidence that suggests the opposite. Faced with the choice of either abandoning the conspiracy theory or doubling down on it, they have to choose one or the other. Those who choose to double down constitute the increasingly radicalized core at the heart of a conspiracy theory. No need to point out what is top of mind as I write this. Summing it all up, I could tease out more similarities and differences between investing and conspiracy theories, but I will stop here. The field of behavioral finance has done a great job of documenting the manifold human biases and how they impact decision making. I do not want to trespass on ground that is already well trodden any more than I have already done so. If at any point in this memo I erred off-piste into discussing topics in the field of medicine, I ask for your forbearance. It was not my intention, and I emphasize that I am not qualified to do so. At the base of this memo is an anecdote that I've used to try and make a little bit more sense of the world. At the same time, I realize that simply stating that something is an anecdote does not absolve the author of responsibility for its content. I hope the consequence of this memo is that by appealing to people's self-interest in their own mental health, they are more reluctant to engage in conspiracy theories. The damage to society by the decision of Trump supporters to storm the Capitol last week has been well documented. The potential damage to their own mental health, less so, not to mention the real-world consequences of breaking and entering not just into any old building, but the seat of American democracy. If a further consequence of this memo is that it makes you a slightly better investor, then that is an added bonus.